You're listening to WSB here at Stony Brook. It's 1228, Classical Interlude, underwritten by Anthony Mata. State Farm Insurance, located on Route 347, that's Wisconsin Highway, here in Portchef Station. I believe I have my guest on the line, Gabriel Walensky. Hello?
Hi, Mort.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Yourself?
Okay, did you recover from last week?
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, great. I spoke with Gabriel last week on his book titled 6 Million Crucifixions. And the subtitle is How Christian Teachings About Jews Paved the Road to the Holocaust. Now, that's a very sensitive topic. In light of not just the Holocaust, which was powerful enough, but the attempts to have Pope Pius XII become a saint. Okay, so I wanted to spend some time talking about what he did and what he didn't do and what others did that perhaps were better suited to the saving of the Jews during the Holocaust. Now, there's a question I wanted to raise. I don't know if you can hear me on this. I just thought of it, not that I hadn't entertained it before. If you're going to be involved with the Satan or the satanic forces in the world, are there any limits on what can be done to those forces? I mean, including the offspring of Satan, namely the Jews and their children. Is it true that some within the church hierarchy considered the Jews a satanic force?
I think that it was very prevalent in Christianity ever since the Middle Ages that Jews were associated with Satan. This was at all levels, from the very top all the way to the lowly peasants in medieval Europe. This actually came about because in the Christian mind, especially Christian theologians and thinkers started to ask the question: what kind of creature would deny God, or would even kill God? Would deny the revelation that Jesus was the Messiah and the Son of God? And since they couldn't come up with any answer that no type of human being would actually deny all this, which to them was self-evidently obvious, they concluded that it was not a human person at all, that the only type of creature that would deny all this would be a minion of the devil. It would be somebody that worked for Satan, that was a Satan's emissary, and had a malevolent bent, and therefore had to be eliminated from Christendom. And of course, elimination during the Middle Ages didn't mean the same as elimination during the Nazi period. It meant just segregating Jews and keeping them separate from Christians. Mm-hmm. But of course, this was the beginning of a process that culminated in the Second World War, where elimination took a much more lethal meaning. Okay. But in the church and everywhere else in Christendom, it was quite obvious to everyone that Jews were associated with the devil, and they actually started to spread all sorts of things related to that notion. They believed that the Jews had a special type of odor that was sort of, you know, sulfuric or demonic in the kind of smell it was. Mm-hmm. They typically portrayed Jews in their art with horns and hooves and tails. So it's interesting for us as modern people to think of this, and we kind of find it preposterous, of course, but in Middle Ages, this was a very real thing, and for the normal common person at the time, Jews were indeed associated with the devil. Now, it's important to also point out that during the Second World War, the people who perpetrated the Holocaust, both Germans, Austrians, as well as the peoples of the countries they conquered in Ukraine, Latvia, Lithuania, and other places, who very gladly and willingly killed Jews, were not necessarily driven by these medieval notions. They didn't necessarily think, oh, I'm going to kill you, Jew, because you're a devil. They were not necessarily thinking of this. However, There's no question that this sort of thing passed from father to son for many, many generations was influential. There's no question that the people in the Second World War period hated Jews viscerally because they had heard that sort of thing, as well as many other similar things, forever. For since the time they understood language, they heard that the Jews were evil and bent on defiling the Christian mind and all sorts of nasty things like this. And all this actually stems from this kind of medieval notions, like the Jews were demonic and other things similar to it as well.
Yeah, but I'm you know, the killing of another human, in order to do that, that human has to be transformed in your own mind to something less than human. And if you extend that to the children, I'm talking babies, where you could, you know, destroy them.
Yeah, but you know, this is actually quite common, unfortunately, in human beings to do this sort of thing. And not only against Jews. I mean, there are all kinds of persecutions and genocides in which children and babies were affected too, because, you know, the perpetrators believed that they were either subhuman or enemies or anything, and therefore had no problem in killing children. This was, you know, in Rwanda, the Hutus murdered millions of, not millions, hundreds of thousands of people, and many of them were children and babies and so on. They had no problem in doing this. And during the Second World War, many children were murdered for the same reason. Also keep in mind that when it comes to the children, the perpetrators typically follow this line of logic. They think and that the children will, if they let them live after having killed their parents, grandparents, and other family members, if they let them live, then these children will eventually grow up to look for revenge. So the rationale is, we need to kill them now, because otherwise these are going to be our enemies in the future. That's the way it works with these people.
Yeah, no, it's important for me anyway to understand the workings of that mentality that, in a sense, reduces a human being to an insect. It's like someone wants to stamp out roaches, and all of a sudden the roaches that have offspring tiny, you got to kill them too.
Yes, and you know, and again, here we see another progression of this mechanism at work. Again, in Christendom during the Middle Ages, the people typically referred to Jews as vampires who wanted to suck the blood of the Christians. They concocted weird allegations, like the Jews killed Christian children to extract their blood to make Passover bread. They called them all sorts of names from the animal kingdom and from death. And this kind of lexicon was eventually updated into much more secular and modern terms, particularly at the end of the 19th century, when anti-Semitism became much more racial in nature, and for sure during the Nazi era, the terms shifted and they became something much more modern. They talked about parasites and a virus that needed to be eradicated. You know, they referred to Jews in these terms. So, you know, the fact that they changed these terms doesn't necessarily change anything in terms of how they conceived of them. The 14th century Christian thought of Jews as a vampire that wanted to suck your blood, and the Nazis thought of the Jews as an insect that also wanted to suck your blood. So, you know, in reality, it doesn't change anything. It's just really just updating the lexicon.
Okay. Was there any commentary within the formal church itself that accepted the idea that the Jews took the children, the Christian children, and killed them for their blood? Was there anything formally said within the church fathers?
Yeah, the church fathers did not, but the some members of the clergy and some popes actually defended Jews when this kind of allegation became quite common after the 12th century, the blood libel. What they actually said was that the Jews were not doing this sort of thing, and they tried to exonerate the Jews from doing this horrible deed. However, you know, keep in mind that this was so entrenched in the minds of people who were prepared to accept any story about Jews that they just couldn't eradicate it. They couldn't actually convince the regular folks, you know, the peasants and the blacksmiths and whatnot, that they should not believe this nonsense about Jews. Because you know, keep in mind that for centuries, allegations like this one and others, you know, like the Jews were guilty of causing the Black Plague and other things of that nature, had been circulating in Europe, and they were so common, so prevalent, that it was just second nature for Christians to believe this sort of thing about Jews. So when the popes, when this thing got nasty and people started to get really violent against Jews, and popes felt that they had to defend them, you know, and protect the good Christian name, if you will, and say, you know, the Jews are not guilty for causing the Black Plague. Look, they are dying just as much as any Christian, and they're not guilty of killing Christian boys to extract blood and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. When they were saying all these things, they just found that they fell in deaf ears because people already wanted to believe all this stuff.
Okay, how late is this? What's the most recent moment when the Jews were accused of killing Christian children and taking their blood? There was a time in Russian history, I'm trying to think of the name of the person, they made a movie of it, where they accused this person of killing the Christian child for the purpose of taking the blood. How far back do we have to go to find this?
No, unfortunately, not too long ago. You know, even during the
Bayless was the name of the guy that this story was about. It was a true story.
Yeah, there was that, but they were actually common in other places as well. Right. And this is in recent times, even right. You know, like close to the Second World War in Syria, there was a very serious allegation that Jews had done this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it turned into almost like a lynching situation. You know, people really believed it, and it was pretty bad. And it was actually quite recent times. It was not we're not talking about Middle Ages, even though it was quite common back then. Mm-hmm. But even in the 19th and early 20th century.
Right. There was a film out, I don't know if you are familiar with it, a foreign film. It was made in Eastern Europe. And it was about this lumberman. There were Jews who, you know, cut trees and sent them down the river. And all of a sudden, a woman turns up dead. And they blame the Jews for doing this. And there was a trial there. And this was in the 1900s.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, it might have been 1920, 1930.
Sure.
So whenever there was a problem, like a plague or a particular death, and they wanted an easy answer for the cause of the problem, the Jew was there.
Not only that, but, you know, again, you know, what we see in the progression of anti-Semitism is that anti-Semitism is a very fluid hatred, and it morphs itself from one thing to another, and it adapts itself to the times. For instance, in 1919, there was a giant massacre, a genocide of Jews in the Ukraine.
Right, I know.
And almost a million people were murdered.
Right, right, right. I know of that one.
And it was a horrible thing. But you know, the Ukrainians who killed Jews at the time, of course, these were not Nazis. They were not brainwashed by Joseph Goebbels' racial anti-Semitism propaganda. These people were driven by their ancient ancestral hatred of Jews. Mm-hmm. But the rationale for it, the ostensible reason for it at the time was that Jews were supposedly Bolsheviks, mm-hmm. who of course had caused a horrible famine in the Ukraine, and therefore they wanted to get back at the Bolsheviks, mm-hmm. and they believed in their mind, and this was quite common in church circles, that the Jews were guilty of creating communism. And they were behind, you know, communism and the Bolsheviks, and therefore, it was the right thing to do to get back at the Jews, because the Jews were behind atheistic Bolshevism, which, of course, for the church was the real number one enemy.
Some years ago, I located an author of a book called "An Echo in My Blood" that talks about that genocide at the end of World War I. where the atrocities put upon the Jews were at least as bad as what the Nazis did, meaning some of them were buried in the ground up to their heads, and then they had horses ride over them. And then they were butchered and thrown into the rivers. And this was before World War II, before the Nazis.
Yeah, absolutely. They were. It was actually quite medieval, you know, in the methods that they used. And they used, of course, all sorts of cutting objects, and people were cut to pieces. And you know, mothers were raped in front of their children, and, you know, fathers were extracted from their houses in front of their families and killed right in front of them in the most barbaric ways. And this sort of thing was unfortunately quite common. And the methods were the same ones used by the Ustasha, the Croatian fascist regime that was established as a puppet state by the Nazis in Croatia. And this was an ultra-Catholic regime, and they were bent on destroying the enemies of the Church, which at the time and that place meant the Jews and the Serbian Orthodox. And they went on a rampage, killing hundreds of thousands of people. They established concentration camps modeled after the German concentration camps. And they killed all kinds of people in the most horrible ways. And this was, I mean, truly barbaric and medieval. You know, they were gouging eyes out, and they were cutting people's stomachs and getting their bowels out while the people were still alive, hacking people to pieces. I mean, it was just absolutely horrible. And this was not in the Middle Ages, by the way. This was in 1942 or 43.
Now, the president of Croatia was a Catholic priest, yes?
No. The Catholic priest president was in Slovakia. That was Father Tiso. The leader of Croatia was called Ante Pavelić. And he was not a priest, but he was a devout Catholic who actually wrote to the Pope and visited Pope Pius XII in the Vatican in 41, I think it was. But he was not a priest, but he was a very deeply religious person. Okay. Many members of the Ustasha regime were priests, though. They were actually people in robes. As a matter of fact, the commandant of the Jasenovac concentration camp in Croatia, which was as bad as anything the Nazis had done in Auschwitz and any other place, minus the gas chambers, everything else was the same. This guy would actually kill hundreds of people every night with his own hands, you know, strangle them or cut their heads or whatever, and often he would actually wear his friar robes. So he would be dressed as a priest, particularly for the occasion of killing these Serbian Orthodox and Jews.
Was he a priest?
He was a priest, but this was not the president. This was not the president of the of Croatia. This was a guy. His name escapes me right now, but this was a Franciscan friar who was the commandant of Jasenovac.
Okay, but he wasn't the only priest in Croatia who killed Jews, right? There were others.
Oh, there were many others. It was quite common, and they were actually roving Croatia. They were moving around. These were not in concentration camps only. These were people moving around and killing any Orthodox Jews or Gypsies that they found.
Right.
And again, they did it with these horrific methods, and some of them were actually wearing robes. They were wearing the frocks.
Now, Anton Pavelić, you said, was the president of Croatia. He was aware of this at the time, right?
Of course.
And was he?
I mean, he actually was the leader. He was.
Okay, and I understand that not only did he meet with the Pope Pius XII, but Pius praised him.
Yes, you know, keep in mind, you know, for the Church, Croatia was one of the preferred children of the Church. You know, like France and Brazil. You know, ultra Catholic countries that the Catholic Church loved. And, you know, the crusade, for lack of a better word, because I think it was a crusade, that was waged by the Croatians against the Orthodox and against the Jews, was something that the Church, in a way, liked, because they liked the notion of removing their enemies, their perceived enemies. And it's something that the churches have done, you know, both the Protestant and the Orthodox and the Catholic Church had done for centuries. They were always fighting each other and trying to destroy each other. And this was not the first, but hopefully the last, of these really horrible massacres between them. But the reality is that they had done it for forever. So the church supported, in a way, tacitly, but supported this kind of genocide. The church definitely knew what was going on in Croatia. It was just across a land of water. It was not that far. They knew what was going on there. And they still met with Pope Pius XII still met with the delegation from Croatia. As a matter of fact, the British Foreign Office, when they knew that this was happening, they called, in an internal memo, they called Pope Pius XII the greatest moral coward of our age, when they knew that he was doing this sort of thing.
Okay, the update on that is when Yugoslavia started disintegrating, who recognized Croatia as an independent state was both the Vatican and Germany. This is now in our time.
Yeah.
Okay, so the getting Croatia into its fold, so to speak, didn't end with World War II. And what was peculiar about it, the United States turns out to be the ally of the former Nazis in Croatia in a disintegration of Yugoslavia against the Serbs, who were our allies in World War II.
Of course, but, there's all kinds of geopolitical reasons for this. And, sometimes we in the U.S. and other every country makes strange bedfellows sometimes. The Croatian Ustasha became a very important pawn in the post-war era because they became the so-called freedom fighters. They became an army that the American, the British, and the Vatican helped to escape Europe after the Second World War because they wanted to have an army to fight the communists. Mm. So all kinds of Nazis were spirited out of Europe with the help of some Vatican officials, and a lot of Croatian Ustasha were spirited out of Europe as well, including Pavelić, who ended up in Argentina as an advisor to Perón, to General Perón, who was the president there.
How high were these officials? I understand they went up to the one who replaced Pius XII.
Yes, he was Cardinal Montini.
Montini was also involved in what was called the Rat Line, right?
Exactly. Even though the priest who there were two main people involved in the Vatican who were involved in the Rat Lines. One of them was Bishop Hudal, who was a German, very pro-Nazi German, and stationed in the Vatican, and he helped many notorious Nazis escape, including Adolf Eichmann, Mengele, and many others. But when he became too notorious, he was replaced by a much more quiet and less conspicuous, but much more effective Croatian father called Father Draganovic. And he was part of the Croatian delegation in the Vatican, and it was a seminary which trained Croatian priests. And he was very, very effective in spiriting people out of Europe, and in particular the Ustasha and some Nazis. And he met regularly with Montini. And so even though there is no proof, there is no document or smoking gun that shows that Pope Pius XII knew about this, I think it's very likely that he must have known this because the Cardinal Montini was almost like a second in command to Pius XII. He met with him twice a day. Pius XII was a micromanager who knew everything that was going on. And so he must have known this too. And Montini and others in the Vatican Curia helped Draganovic in his efforts in a number of different ways, in providing assistance through the commission of assistance that the Vatican had, and in the printing presses and other things that that they had to their command. And also keep in mind that the Ustasha were the Croatians were very effective. They had a network in essence set up in various different places, not only in the Vatican but other places in Rome, and because they they had connections in other places, like in Genoa. They managed to get Nazis and Ustasha out of the Vatican, in essence, under the nose of the Allies who were looking for them. They got them to Genoa. They gave them passage. They gave them food and money, and they put them on a ship, and they send them out to wherever they could go. Most of them, Argentina, but many of them into the U.S., the U.K., right. Canada, and Australia. And the Vatican, I shouldn't say the Vatican because it wasn't the general Vatican, but certainly some members of the Vatican who were doing this for the most part because they believed that the that these were you know, a moral reserve that the world could count upon for the future, and they were also the only true bulwark against communism, right. Which again, you know, for the church, this right. was the true enemy. They right. they really feared that if communism took over Europe, that would be the end of the Catholic Church. Which, by the way, I think they were right. I mean, if right. communism had taken over entire Europe, I think they would have actually eradicated the church, like they did in the Soviet Union.
Okay, and that probably is the reason why the, Pius XII is held in such high regard. He saved the church.
At the cost absolutely. But, you know, you could make the argument that he didn't necessarily save the church by doing this. I mean, his interest was for sure to save the church. There's no question that Pius XII did what he did and didn't do what he didn't do because his very first priority, by far, was to save the church, to protect the interests of the church. No question about it. And I don't know if he can be blamed for it. I think that's the right thing to do for him. However, you know, in Christian doctrine, you're supposed to love your neighbor as much as yourself, and the one thing that the church did not do is preach with example. They did not show compassion. They did not show caritas, charity, to anyone other than themselves, the church.
Now, there are exceptions. John the 23rd was an exceptional pope. He identified with the plight of the Jews.
Yeah, John 23rd was a fantastic person. He, you know, his name, Angelo Roncalli, he was the delegate to Turkey, and he worked tirelessly to save Jews when he was stationed there. He had connections with the king of Bulgaria and in other places in the Balkans, and he managed to get false baptismal certificates issued to many Jews, and he really helped. He did. I think he's a perfect example of what people should have done. More people should have done. I think he was a great person. And for and when once he became pope, you know, one of the very first things he did was to remove from the Good Friday prayer. You know, there was this clause there that talks about the perfidious Jews. You know, this expression had been around for a very long time in the Tridentine Mass and in the Good Friday prayer. So he removed this. He removed that, and he removed any words regarding the supposedly blindness of the Jews. And then, so this was right after he had become pope. Mm-hmm. But then shortly afterwards, when he convened the Second Vatican Council, which started in 1962, he was instrumental in pushing the fathers of the church at the time to remove the so-called teaching of contempt for Jews, which had been the cause for so much grief for Jews for many, many centuries. Unfortunately, he died too soon. He didn't live through the entire Second Vatican Council. He died somewhere midway. And you know, if he had lived all the way through, I think that the Nostra Aetate, the declaration, which was issued by Vatican II, would have been much stronger, would have been much better. But it was eventually watered down a little bit, and it was weakened by his successor Montini, who became Paul the VI. And you know, it was quite unfortunate, but still, it was a remarkable and extremely important document. Nostra Aetate is probably one of the greatest things that the Catholic Church has done in recent years, for sure.
I understand he went so far. Now, is this just a story, or is it true? To sit down on the tracks to prevent a train carrying Jews going to the concentration camp, to prevent that train from doing that.
Are you talking about Roncalli?
I'm talking about, yeah, Roncalli.
I'm not aware of that. He might have done this. I doubt it. I don't think he did.
Okay.
But it's possible. I'm not aware of it.
Okay.
It's, you know, one thing I say in my book, in 6 Million Crucifixions, it's interesting that you mentioned this because, you know, when I have a section in which I talk about what Pope Pius XII should have done.
Right.
And one of the things that I mention is that he should have done this. He, you know, when the Jews of Rome were deported in 1943, and then, you know, pretty much all of them perished in Auschwitz, before they were taken away, my contention was that the Pope should have actually stood in front of the train and stood on the tracks, preventing the train from moving. And of course, the Germans would have actually just forcibly removed him from there. There's no question about it. But the important thing of having done that is that he would have electrified the Christian world. I think it would have been a very important symbol, a very important sign of papal support for the Jews and an opposition to this policy of deporting Jews to their deaths. Because, you know, keep in mind that Pius XII never openly really declared that killing Jews was a crime and a mortal sin. He never actually said this. And so, you know, I think that this became the deportation of the Jews of Rome, the worst aspect of his inactivity or his lack of saying anything.
Was Pius XII an anti-Semite? Did he hate the Jews as a consequence of their rejection of Christ and their acceptance of Bolshevism, which was the Antichrist?
So I think we need to qualify that. I don't think he was an anti-Semite in the Nazi sense, meaning of the word. He was for sure. He was not a racial anti-Semite, and he was not a rabid anti-Semite for sure. However, he was a fruit of his time and of his place. He absorbed the Catholic education typical of the time, and the Catholic education typical of the time taught contempt at best for Jews, and therefore I think he actually felt that the Jews were the killers of Christ, and he felt that, you know, certain contempt for Jews and Judaism. Now, this is not the same thing as feeling hatred for them, but he certainly didn't feel much love for them either.
Well, if you can accept the Jews as the killers of Christ, how could you avoid hatred? That's like, how do you do that? Yeah, these people killed Christ, and but I don't hate them. What does he take? What position does he move to?
Well, I don't know. I think that you know, rationally, I think a Christian could think of that and could say, well, you know, Christ was supposed to die for our sins, and therefore it's immaterial why he died or who killed him.
Okay.
Because, you know, it was ordained that he was supposed to die. So I think he might have thought of it that way, you know, saying, well, even if the Jews were guilty of killing Christ, which they weren't, but even if they had been, you know, it's immaterial. It doesn't really matter because thanks to them, Jesus died for me. And that's something that I think all Christians should probably be thinking of and be thankful for whoever killed him. You know, as horrible as that is, but, you know, the reality is that in Christian theology, if you believe that Jesus died for your for your sins, then it should not matter who killed him.
You're listening to WUSB at Stony Brook. I'm speaking with Gabrielle Walensky. It's a book that everyone should read. The title is 6 Million Crucifixions, How Christian Teachings About the Jews Paved the Road to the Holocaust. There's another question. Was Pius XII pro-Nazi?
No, I don't think he was pro-Nazi. He actually signed a concord at an agreement with Nazi Germany in 1933, shortly after Hitler had taken power. But he did this out of convenience. He did this just in the same way as the Church always did and does, is to sign agreements with foreign powers to protect the interests of the Church. Mm-hmm. And in Germany, the Vatican and the Church had considerable interests, not only economical, because after the Lateran Pact, Mussolini gave the Vatican lots of money in order to in exchange for the papal states, basically, and they invested a lot of it in German industry and other things in Germany. But the Church had a giant infrastructure in Germany. They had a very large organization of institutions, of churches, of schools, of youth organizations, all manner of organization, Catholic organizations. So the way the church has traditionally protected these kind of interests, especially in modern times when the church did not have the power that they will, that it wielded in medieval times with foreign powers, is to sign this agreement. So Pope Pius XII signed a concordat before he became pope. Actually, he was Cardinal Pacelli, the Secretary of State back then. But he signed this agreement with Nazi Germany. But shortly afterwards, the Nazis, of course, disregarded all the agreements, and they started to do all kinds of nasty things to the church as well, to the Jews, of course, but to the church as well, not respecting the agreement, and in essence persecuting the church in some ways. So Pius XII didn't really feel any love for Hitler or the Nazis. He understood them very well. He had lived in Germany for a very long time, and he was quite pro-Germanic, but he was not very pro-Nazi at all. He disliked Nazism. He believed it was a heresy. However, Pacelli was a very, very capable man, and he was a very, very seasoned diplomat, and he knew the ways of the world, and he understood, I think, in his ultimate calculation, he understood that as bad as the Nazis were, they were not as bad as the communists. And they were the only bulwark against mm-hmm. communism.
Right.
So, in his realpolitik calculation, he must have known right. that was true. And this might be one of the reasons. I think there were probably several, but this might maybe one of the reasons why he never openly confronted the Nazis. He never actually issued an encyclical or a pastoral letter read from every pulpit in every church in every place in Christian Europe, condemning the Nazis, condemning their evil ideology, condemning the murder of Jews and other minorities. He never said any of this because he didn't really want to antagonize the Germans.
Mm-hmm. Okay. He claimed during the war, supposedly, that he was neutral. The Allies attempted to get him to do what you suggested, condemn the Nazis. He said, I can't. I'm not going to take a position on either side of this. However, in Saul Friedlander's book, Pius XII and the Third Reich, he says the Pope explicitly said, as the war was ending, pleading with the Allies on the Western Front, the British and the Americans, to stop fighting the Germans, join them, and fight against the Russians.
Well, that's pretty outrageous, but, he also, it's the notion of neutrality, ostensibly, that was his rationale. It's true. He was actually saying, I cannot say anything because I'm neutral, so I can condemn atrocities in general, but I cannot say Nazi atrocities or German atrocities. That was his rationale. However, I think we have to take that with a grain of salt. The Vatican actually breached its neutrality when the Germans invaded the Low Countries, Belgium and Holland. They actually protested. The Vatican protested and wrote a telegram to the king, to the queen there. And therefore, they breached neutrality. So, I think that if we look at the track record of the Vatican during the Second World War, we see that whenever they wanted to protect interests that mattered to them, for instance, during the 1930s, when the Germans wanted to remove crucifixes from classroom walls, mm-hmm. they protested. Mm-hmm. When the Nazis were killing the infirm and the mentally ill and so on, the church protested. When the Germans invaded the Low Countries, the church protested. However, these were things that really mattered to the church. When the church tried to deport Jews who had converted to Catholicism, they protested and they tried to protect them. Jews and Christians who were married, and these so-called mixed marriages, they protected the Christians in those marriages. So, we see a slew of examples of cases in which the church protected those things that they felt they had to protect. They did not feel they had to protect the Jews, and we see some cases of individuals, and some cases of just Christian folk who protected Jews during the war, but we do not see an official church effort to protect Jews, or even worse, we see no effort from the part of the church to instruct the faithful that killing Jews was a mortal sin and a crime. And this is instrumental because, you know, the Vatican didn't have airplanes, and didn't have cannons, so, you know, obviously it would be naive to think, well, the Vatican could not just fight the Germans. So obviously they could not fight the Germans. But they could actually fight the Germans in a much better way, because the one thing the Vatican had, even though it didn't have cannons, it did have the ears and hearts of hundreds of millions of Catholics worldwide, and probably many Protestants as well in that kind of circumstance. So if the Vatican had felt that they had to protect the Jews, they should have done more than just simply open the doors of a convent or a church in Rome or somewhere and give shelter to a few dozen or a few hundred Jews. They should have actually done much more than that. And the one thing that would have made a big difference, I think, is if they had actually instructed clearly, in no uncertain terms, through flyers thrown from the airplanes, in Vatican radio, BBC, or any other means of communication, talking from the pulpits, talking military chaplains, talking to the troops in the front, any means of communication possible, if they had told the people killing the perpetrators, killing Jews, this is wrong, this is a crime, and this is a mortal sin, if they had excommunicated all these people,
right,
they had threatened with excommunication to these people and to the German hierarchy, I think this would have made a big difference. It may have actually triggered a moral revolt against genocide. I think it would have changed things. But they did not do it.
If you were a Catholic that embraced communism, would he have excommunicated you?
He didn't do it during the war. He certainly did it after the war, when he had no qualms in excommunicating every single communist in the world at one stroke.
They didn't do it before the war? Wasn't there the threat of excommunication before World War II started? If you were a Catholic and you became a communist, you no longer were a Catholic. No?
He didn't excommunicate them during the war or before the war. He excommunicated them after the war.
Okay.
Also keep in mind that after the war, Pius XII was getting really nervous about communism. I mean, he had been really nervous since 1917, but after the war, when Stalin not only was standing, but was standing strong in Eastern Europe, he became really nervous. And also keep in mind that in post-war Italy, communism was taking a hold. It was actually becoming really powerful.
I know.
And Pius XII was really, really afraid of a communist takeover of Italy, because he knew that would have been the end.
Right. But the fear among the West was that, and Stalin was part of that, was that when the elections come about after World War II in France and Italy, who's going to win the elections are the communists, because they were the only ones really fighting the Nazis.
Yeah.
This was the concern. That's why the United States was told, instructed the Italian-Americans, write your relatives in Italy, I think it was the election in 47, 48, tell them, don't vote communist, don't vote, right, because Stalin was saying, okay, you guys, you like voting, fine, I'll let them vote because I know who's going to win, but the United States helped stop that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not true that the communists were the only ones fighting the Nazis, obviously, but it was certainly true for a while, but not throughout the entire war.
Of all of them that were fighting the Nazis, it was the communists primarily. They didn't collaborate. They knew what that meant.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, they were the ones, of all of them, they were the pure anti-Nazis in France and in Italy who were fighting against fascism. No way. Now, if the Pope had threatened excommunication to the German military, the troops, if they had killed Jews, would that have had an effect?
I don't think it would have had much of an effect with some troops, especially the SS. I think the SS were probably beyond redemption. I mean, these people were so brainwashed and so fanatical that it probably would not have made much of a difference what the Pope said. However, you know, the SS was only a tiny fraction of the perpetrators. The SS were perhaps 100,000 people, and the perpetrators were millions. You know, the perpetrators were not just the people pulling the trigger. Perpetrators were the bystanders who were laughing at the Nazis taking a bearded Jew into the streets and cutting his beard, or you know, killing him in front of everyone, or making this guy brush the street with a toothbrush. The perpetrators were the train drivers, the train engineers who were taking the cattle car trains to the death camps. Mm-hmm. The perpetrators were the factory worker in Germany making Cyclone B, the poison gas that was used to kill Jews in gas chambers. So these were regular individuals. These were not fanatical SS henchmen. The perpetrators were also people who were not even German. The perpetrators were people in Lithuania or Ukraine who were very happy to comply with a request by the Germans to help them kill the Jews. They were the ones that were denouncing the Jews. Of course, these were the neighbors, so they were saying, you know, there's Moshe, the Jew. You know, they were like pointing at the neighbors because the Nazis couldn't tell sometimes who were the Jews. They didn't know what they were. So the neighbors, their Christian neighbors, were the ones denouncing them. Many times, they were the ones helping the Germans round them up and take them to a forest. And often, and if not most of the times, especially at the beginning of the Holocaust, before the concentration camps began to be used as death camps, the murder was done by this roving killing squads, the Einsatzgruppen, and also the Order Police, and these people were going all along the Eastern Front, taking Jews from these little villages into ravines, into forests, and killing them at point blank range sometimes, but oftentimes with machine guns, at the edge of a mass grave. But the interesting thing about it is that the people manning the machine guns or the rifles or whatever other method of murder were not only uniformed SS. They were oftentimes Lithuanians and Latvians and Poles and Ukrainians and Romanians and other people as well. In France, for instance, France, of course, is a very Catholic country, and it's one of the Church's favorite daughters. And in France, the deportation of the Jews into the Drancy camp before they were deported to the death camps was done entirely by gendarmes, the French police. These were not the Nazis. These were not German Gestapo or SS who rounded up the Jews. These were the French. They were regular French. They were the neighbors of the people. You know, these were regular folks who their children probably went to school with other Jewish children. These were the people who rounded up the Jews and handed them over to the Germans, who later killed them. So, you know, these were regular individuals, and the important thing about it is that these individuals were not driven as the fanatical SS. They were not driven by a decade of racial propaganda, driven by the hundreds and hundreds of years of anti-Jewish contempt, anti-Jewish hatred instilled in them by the Church.
Did the Church make it easy for those to identify the Jews by on the baptismal papers that they supplied to the authorities?
They did, and this is was another unfortunate thing that happened. But this was not the Catholic Church in general. This was particularly the German Catholic Church. But the German Protestant churches did as well. During the 1930s, the Germans were doing their typical census, and they didn't know who the Jews were. They couldn't tell, because in Germany the Jews were probably the most assimilated Jews of any other place, and so they couldn't tell. They didn't dress differently, they didn't speak differently, they didn't look differently at all. They were just like any regular German. So what the German authorities did is they went to the the churches and they asked them for baptismal records, which the church very happily complied with, and they gave them the baptismal records. They gave them this, which was instrumental in allowing the German authorities to know who was a Christian, and by opposition, who was a Jew. That's how they identified who was a Christian, because they were baptized. And they knew who the Jews were, and then they knew where they lived and everything. And they actually tabulated this with machines provided by IBM Germany, and they actually kept very meticulous records, as is typical of the Germans. And they knew exactly who they were, what kind of income they had, where they lived, you know, all the stuff they knew. And when the genocide, I mean, the persecution was gradual, right? You started by stripping the Jews of nationality and preventing them from holding office and preventing them from being professors in universities and schools and so on. But by the time it became genocidal, you know, toward the Second World War time frame, in 1939 and onwards, they actually went straight to the Jews because they know who they were and they knew where they lived, thanks to the church in great part.
Okay. Again, my guest, Gabriel Walensky, his book, important read, 6 Million Crucifixions, How Christian Teachings About the Jews Paved the Road to the Holocaust. After the war ends and Poland and the other countries are liberated, there were pogroms taking place in Poland. What did the church do about those pogroms? That was after the Nazis lost the war.
Yes. Yeah, there was a very... This was quite unfortunate. I mean, it was really not that surprising if you think about it this way. After the Second World War, the ancient hatred for Jews did not disappear. It would not just, I mean, if you hated Jews all your life and during the war you killed Jews because you felt that they were hateful and they had to be eliminated, you know, the fact that the war ended would not necessarily change this overnight. So yes, there were pogroms, and particularly in Poland, you know, Jews were of course decimated there. It was the greatest massacre of Jews occurred in Poland, and the remaining ones, once the war ended, were trying to come back home, and they somehow made it back to their villages and towns, only to find that their homes were taken over by their Christian neighbors. And that they couldn't go back to their houses because they didn't have any of those anymore. They didn't have any of their possessions. All this stuff had been taken away. And they were actually literally persecuted by the local population at that point. And the pogroms happened even after the war. And incidentally, they also happened. The other thing that happened, you were asking about the blood libel earlier.
Right.
And there was one particular pogrom in 1946 in Poland where they actually concocted this thing. They actually instructed, believe it or not, they instructed a child to complain that the Jews had kidnapped him and they wanted to kill him to extract his blood or kill him.
Okay.
And therefore, there was like a mock trial or something, and of course the child was forced to testify saying, yeah, the Jews did this, and therefore there was a pogrom. It was a massive revolt, and it was very violent. They destroyed a community center, and they killed a few Jews, some of which actually were not even there. They were just passing through this town, because, you know, remember, after the war, people were moving across Europe, you know, trying to find their way. So these were people who were completely innocent of anything because they were not in living there at the time. Yet they were attacked anyway just simply because they were Jews. And so this pogrom became very notorious, and because it not only was wrong, but also because, you know, Cardinal Hlong, who actually who was the primate of Poland at the time, he actually was asked, you know, how come you permit this? You know, what's going on? He said, well, you know, the Jews must have done it. That was basically his answer. You know, his response or his opinion was that, you know, there must be a reason for it. and this became particularly interesting. Many, many years later, this child, as a grown man, actually confessed that he had been made to lie and to say this about the Jews by his parents and uncle, I think it was, and some other family member. So this was a horrible thing, and it was horrible from every point of view, but it was interesting in the sense that, as opposed to the other blood libels of the Middle Ages and other times, this time the child, you know, became, you know, felt guilty about it and actually confessed later that it was all a lie. It was a concocted lie specifically designed to persecute Jews.
But the anti-Semites still wouldn't buy that. They would still argue that he was, and he's now under the influence of the Jew.
Yeah, the anti-Semites don't need to operate under the under reason. I mean, they doesn't have to be rational. They will do what they do, and it doesn't really matter what anybody says. You can actually, you know, prove the law of gravity in front of them, and they would argue that, no, it's not true, and the earth is flat. It doesn't really matter what you tell them.
Now, this post-World War II pogroms that were taking place in Poland, it wasn't just for a couple of people. I understand that maybe over 1,000 Jews were killed by the Poles when they went home.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. This was happening all the time, and it was happening during the war, too. The Poles, actually, there was a militia. I can't remember the name. It was something with an S. It was some acronym for a Polish word. It just escapes my mind right now. But it was a militia of Poles, of Christian Poles, who persecuted Jews during the war as well. Like in Poland, of course, Jews were trying to hide wherever they could. They were being hounded by the Germans, but also by the Poles, which is the point here. They were trying to find shelter in forests, in farms. It didn't really matter. They would very gladly sleep under the hay, you know, with the cows or the pigs, and they would hide wherever they could. And then you would have these roving bands of armed Poles who were looking for them, and they were, like, you know, ferreting them out from their hiding places and either killing them themselves or handing them over to the Germans.
Okay. A further question. Was it John Paul II? He was the Polish Pope?
John Paul II was the Polish Pope, yes.
Okay. Now, what was his record during World War II in terms of the question of what was happening to the Jews? And what did he do in Poland when the pogroms took place after World War II? Did he address any of those questions?
I think he was a young man at the time. He was in the seminary, I believe, to study for the priesthood during that time or shortly after. Mm-hmm. He was against it. I think he was a good man who opposed this thing. He saw that this was an aberration and it was not the right Christian thing to do, so he felt bad about it even at that time. And I think he felt that he had to fight it in some way. But he also felt very strongly against communism, so he was trying to fight that as well, which he did all his life. And as a matter of fact, you know, John Paul II was, of course, very instrumental in the fight with communism during the Cold War, and was instrumental in the fall of communism in some ways.
How old was John Paul at 1945? How old was he at that time?
I don't know for sure, but he was a young man. He must have been in his teens, probably.
I think he must have been older. He must have been older. Okay? I would put him, how old would he be today if he still lived? I would take him to be in his 20s or 30s, so he must have been aware, hopefully, of the pogroms that were taking place. Incidentally, when I speak to some of my Christian friends on occasion, and I mention the Jews, you know, when they went back to Poland and were killed, the immediate response is, oh, by the Russians. I said, no, by the Poles. They can't process the information in their minds that evil is beyond communism.
Yeah. He was born in 1920. So in 1945, he was 25 years old.
Right.
As I said, he was studying for the seminary at this time. He certainly knew of all the stuff that was going on against the Jews. He might have not known the particulars of some pogrom here or there, but he certainly knew of Polish persecution of Jews, and absolutely he knew German persecution of Jews.
Okay. Now there's maybe a final question for this section is... What's your comment for the expression that the Church, the Vatican, saved more Nazis after the war than Jews during the war?
It's hard to know the numbers of either of them for sure. It's if you count the number of Ustasha that were removed from Europe, the Galician division that were spirited out to the UK, it's possible that there were more fascists and Nazis than Jews. But you know, I don't know for sure. I don't think anybody knows for sure these numbers at this point. Maybe when the Vatican secret archives are open,
yeah,
and documentation comes to light as to acts of shelter and acts of saving Jews by the Vatican, we'll know. But for the time being, I don't think anybody knows for sure the exact numbers.
Okay. What do you think about the Pius XII's possibility of becoming a saint? Do you think that's on track?
Of being canonized?
Yeah.
I think it's a mistake to do it at this point. You know, obviously, it's the prerogative of the Church to canonize whoever they want. Mm-hmm. However, I think it would be premature to do it right now before the archives are open and independent scholars have a chance to evaluate what he did and what he didn't do during the war. So it is very possible that Pope Pius XII was a saintly man. However, before we know this for sure, and with all the controversy around him and with the speculation about what he did and he didn't do, it would be really premature to do it at this point.
Okay. I think in your book you have that quote by Pastor Niemöller. I think the quote was, when they came for the labor unions, I said nothing. When they came for the communist, I didn't speak up. When they came for the Jews, I was silent. You're familiar with that?
Yeah, yeah. It was a poem that he composed.
Right.
He had that exactly.
Yeah. However, in the poem that I see written out, he also was mentioned, when they came for the Catholics, I didn't protest. That was never in the original poem.
I don't think he said that.
No, I have copies of the original poem from the German. He never said that. That was inserted probably by certain people who felt guilty that they weren't included in those who were persecuted by the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
That was an add-on, which is an interest. Whenever I see it in public, I go over to whoever's responsible for it and say, where's that line coming from? That wasn't in the original quote. That was a...
You're right. I mean, I actually have the poem right in front of me,
right,
and in the original, and he doesn't say anything about the Catholics.
No, how did that come into existence? It had to come in, you know, so people wouldn't get too upset about what took place.
Well, and it kind of makes you wonder, because they never came for the Catholics as Catholics. They may have come from Catholics who were...
Yeah, who would be left if they came after all of these people? What were left, the chickens? It's only us chickens that are murdering people?
I don't know, but, you know, the reality is that, you know, Niemöller actually was not a bad man per se, but he actually was, just like Pius XII, a fruit of his time, you know, and he really absorbed the same teachings as everybody else in that period.
Okay, similarly with Bonhoeffer, he was a hero, but these guys are all anti-Semites, even though they're heroes.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's the world. You had the difference between the murderous anti-Semites and those that just hated them or spoke out against them. All right, I want to thank you for being interviewed, Gabriel, and your book is an important book. Okay, 6 million crucifixions, how Christian teaching. We have a little extra time. You mentioned if it wasn't for Christianity, there'd be no Holocaust.
I think it's very unlikely that would have been the case. No, the Holocaust, just like any other genocide, requires at least two things in order for them to happen. One of them is there has to be a pre-existing visceral hatred of one group by another. That's one of the two prerequisites. And the other one is there has to be some leadership, like political leaders who give the green light and provide the infrastructure or the facilitate the genocide to happen. So without these two things, genocides just don't happen, period. And I'm talking about genocides in general, regardless of whether it's in Darfur, in Rwanda, or the Holocaust, or the Armenians, or whatever. If you look at all the history of genocide, you will see these two things. So in the case of the Holocaust, these two things were very, very visible. On the one hand, the pre-existing hatred of Jews was indisputable, and it had come from hundreds and hundreds of years of indoctrination of hatred toward Jews, which changed forms from an original theological to a later secular and rational form. However, it was a visceral hatred that already existed in most people in Europe. And then, of course, the other element was that the Nazis were in power, an all-powerful government who gave the green light to the population to go on a killing rampage. The Germans did not have to coax anyone to go and kill Jews. They just simply told them, go and kill them, and people went and killed them.
Mm-hmm. What about the idea that if no World War II, no Holocaust?
Absolutely not. No. The Holocaust happened under cover, if you will, of the Second World War. If the war had not erupted, I think it's very unlikely that the genocide would have happened in the way it did. The one thing that would have continued to happen was the elimination attempt of the Jews. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that in 1930s Germany, the Germans made very strong efforts toward eliminating Jews from their midst. They passed the Nuremberg Laws in 1935, which were meant to exclude Jews from German life. They stripped their nationality. They prevented them from working in all sorts of professions, and they forced them to emigration. They forced them to leave the country. So, if the war had not erupted, we would have seen this this continued to the point of eliminating Jews from Germany entirely, but eliminating them by pushing them out of the way and not by killing them.
If they were to push them out of the way, which is an argument, where would they have gone? The Allies weren't letting them come into their countries.
Well, but, you know, if the war had not erupted, of course it's speculative. We'll never know what would have happened. But it's very possible, I don't know if very possible, it's certainly possible that they would have actually they would have gone somewhere. If the situation had gotten a lot worse in Germany, you know, the 1938 pogrom, the Kristallnacht pogrom, was a clear indication of how things were turning violent, and I think they could have continued that way. Mm-hmm. For sure it would have continued that way. Mm-hmm. I think it's very possible that American public opinion would have changed, you know, a few years after, and it's very possible that those anti-Semites in the State Department would have actually been forced to revert their policies and opened immigration to European Jews. Okay. I mean, of course, we'll never know, but I think it's very likely that this would have happened. It's also very possible that the same would have happened in the UK. I mean, Churchill was a friend of the Jews, and he would have seen that the situation in Germany was untenable for Jews, and Churchill was no dummy, just like Roosevelt was a very smart man, and he would have seen the benefit of importing, let's say, of accepting immigration by Jews, especially the German Jews, who were the most highly educated and talented Jews anywhere in Europe, probably. You know, these people were scientists and artists and engineers of the highest caliber. So they would have actually benefited from it. And I think they, you know, at the time in the 30s, they would not have accepted it. But I think that if things had continued to go really bad, it's possible that public opinion may have changed.
Okay, we have a little time, so perhaps we can I can continue raising some questions.
Sure.
What about Roosevelt and the charge that was made that why didn't he bomb the camps that the Jews were being exterminated in?
Well, it really wasn't up to Churchill. To Roosevelt to do this. This was really the War Department. They decided not to do this. The War Department, of course, is the predecessor of the. It was the ministry that was in charge of handling the war, and therefore they were the ones that had control over what the military did or didn't do, and what ostensibly was the reason at the time for not bombing the railroad tracks that went from Hungary to Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. Was because they were too far away and they couldn't divert military personnel or materiel into doing that sort of thing. They had to focus on winning the war. And as a matter of fact, Roosevelt often said this. We had to first focus on winning the war. Once if we beat the Nazis, then all this stuff is going to go away. So we need to beat the Nazis. That was the driving force behind everything they were doing. Mm-hmm. However, in reality, I think we now know that this was just lip service and it was not really true rationale for it because the the Allies were saying that they couldn't reach the railroad tracks, they were too far away. But we know now that this was not true, because once the American Allies and the British landed in Sicily and they were on the southern part of the Italian boot, they were already close enough to the Hungarian railroad tracks. So they could have actually reached them. When they continued to go up the boot, and especially after having gone over, liberated Rome and so on, they were already flying in that time frame. They were already flying into Poland. As a matter of fact, Auschwitz actually was three different camps, Auschwitz-Birkenau, and Auschwitz was the first, Birkenau was the second, and there was a third one called Monowitz. And Monowitz was an industrial camp. It was a slave labor camp where they had factories. IG Farben and others were there. And the Allies actually had bombed this camp. They actually had flown bombers, heavy bombers,
right,
and destroyed some of the facilities in this camp, in Auschwitz III. So the contention that they could not, go into Birkenau or Auschwitz in general and drop bombs there because it was too far away, or because they didn't have they didn't want to divert bombers from strategic bombing and, go there or whatever. All this other stuff is just plain sad excuses, because the reality is they were bombing this camp that was in the neighborhood. It was just a few miles away. I think it was 3 miles away or five. So if you could drop bombs on a camp 5 miles away and you don't drop them on the concentration camp gas chambers, it's only because you didn't want to. Available to the Vatican through flyers thrown from the airplanes, in Vatican radio, BBC, or any other means of communication, talking from the pulpits, talking military chaplains talking to the troops in the front, any means of communication possible. If they had told the people killing the perpetrators, killing Jews, this is wrong, this is a crime, and this is a mortal sin, if they had excommunicated all these people,
right,
they had threatened with excommunication to these people and to the German hierarchy, I think this would have made a big difference. It may have actually triggered a moral revolt against genocide. I think it would have changed things. They did not do it.
If you were a Catholic that embraced communism, would he have excommunicated you?
He didn't do it during the war. He certainly did it after the war, when he had no qualms in excommunicating every single communist in the world at one stroke.
They didn't do it before the war? Wasn't there the threat of excommunication before World War II started? If you were a Catholic and you became a communist, you no longer were a Catholic. No?
He didn't excommunicate them during the war or before the war. He excommunicated them after the war.
Okay.
Also keep in mind that after the war, Pius XII was getting really nervous about communism. I mean, he had been really nervous since 1917. But after the war, when Stalin not only was standing, but was standing strong in Eastern Europe, he became really nervous. And also keep in mind that in post-war Europe, I'm sorry, post-war Italy, communism was taking hold. It was actually becoming really powerful.
I know.
And Pius XII was really, really afraid of a communist takeover of Italy, because he knew that would have been the end.
Right. The fear among the West was that, and Stalin was part of that, was that when the elections come about after World War II in France and Italy, who's going to win the elections are the communists, because they were the only ones really fighting the Nazis.
Yeah.
This was the concern. That's why the United States was told, instructed the Italian-Americans, write your relatives in Italy, I think it was the election in 47, 48, tell them, don't vote communist, don't vote, right, because Stalin was saying, okay, you guys, you like voting, fine, I'll let them vote because I know who's going to win, but the United States helped stop that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not true that the communists were the only ones fighting the Nazis, obviously, but was certainly true for a while, but not throughout the entire war.
Of all of them that were fighting the Nazis, it was the communists primarily. They didn't collaborate. They knew what that meant.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, they were the ones, of all of them, they were the pure anti-Nazis in France and in Italy who were fighting against fascism. No way. Now, if the Pope had threatened excommunication to the German military, the troops, if they had killed Jews, would that have had an effect?
I don't think it would have had much of an effect with some troops, especially the SS. I think the SS were probably beyond redemption. I mean, these people were so brainwashed and so fanatical that it probably would not have made much of a difference what the Pope said. However, you know, the SS was only a tiny fraction of the perpetrators. The SS were perhaps 100,000 people, and the perpetrators were millions. You know, the perpetrators were not just the people pulling the trigger. Perpetrators were the bystanders who were laughing at the Nazis taking a bearded Jew into the street and cutting his beard, or you know, killing him in front of everyone, or making this guy brush the street with a toothbrush. The perpetrators were the train drivers, the train engineers who were taking the cattle car trains to the death camps. Mm-hmm. The perpetrators were the factory worker in Germany making Cyclone B, the poison gas that was used to kill Jews in gas chambers. So these were regular individuals. These were not fanatical SS henchmen. The perpetrators were also people who were not even German. The perpetrators were people in Lithuania or Ukraine who were very happy to comply with a request by the Germans to help them kill the Jews. They were the ones that were denouncing the Jews. Of course, these were the neighbors, so they were saying, you know, there's Moshe, the Jew. You know, they were, like, pointing at the neighbors because the Nazis couldn't tell sometimes who were the Jews. They didn't know where they were. So the neighbors, their Christian neighbors, were the ones denouncing them. Many times, they were the ones helping the Germans round them up and take them to a forest. And often, and if not most of the times, especially at the beginning of the Holocaust, before the concentration camps began to be used as death camps, the murder was done by this roving killing squads, the Einsatzgruppen, and also the Order Police, and these people were going all along the Eastern Front, taking Jews from these little villages into ravines, into forests, and killing them at point blank range sometimes, but oftentimes with machine guns, at the edge of a mass grave. But the interesting thing about it is that the people manning the machine guns or the rifles or whatever other method of murder were not only uniformed SS. They were oftentimes Lithuanians and Latvians and Poles and Ukrainians and Romanians and other people as well. In France, for instance, France, of course, is a very Catholic country, and it's one of the Church's favorite daughters. And in France, the deportation of the Jews into the Drancy camp before they were deported to the death camps was done entirely by gendarmes, the French police. These were not the Nazis. These were not German Gestapo or SS who rounded up the Jews. These were the French. They were regular French. They were the neighbors of the people. You know, these were regular folks who their children probably went to school with other Jewish children. These were the people who rounded up the Jews and handed them over to the Germans, who later killed them. So, you know, these were regular individuals, and the important thing about it is that these individuals were not driven as the fanatical SS. They were not driven by a decade of racial propaganda, driven by the hundreds and hundreds of years of anti-Jewish contempt, anti-Jewish hatred instilled in them by the Church.
Did the Church make it easy for those to identify the Jews by on the baptismal papers that they supplied to the authorities?
They did, and this is was another unfortunate thing that happened. But this was not the Catholic Church in general. This was particularly the German Catholic Church. But the German Protestant churches did as well. During the 1930s, the Germans were doing their typical census, and they didn't know who the Jews were. They couldn't tell, because in Germany, the Jews were probably the most assimilated Jews of any other place. And So they couldn't tell. They didn't dress differently. They didn't speak differently. They didn't look differently at all. They were just like any regular German. So what the German authorities did is they went to the churches and they asked them for baptismal records, which the church very happily complied with, and they gave them the baptismal records. They gave them this, which was instrumental in allowing the German authorities to know who was a Christian, and by opposition, who was a Jew. That's how they identified who was a Christian, because they were baptized, and they knew who the Jews were, and then they knew where they lived and everything. They actually tabulated this with machines provided by IBM Germany, and they actually kept very meticulous records, as is typical of the Germans. And they knew exactly who they were, what kind of income they had, where they lived, you know, all the stuff they knew. And when the genocide, I mean, the persecution was gradual, right? It started by stripping the Jews of nationality and preventing them from holding office and preventing them from being professors in universities and schools and so on. But by the time it became genocidal, you know, toward the Second World War time frame, in 1939 and onwards, they actually went straight to the Jews because they know who they were and they knew where they lived, thanks to the church in great part.
Okay. Again, my guest, Gabriel Walensky, his book, important read, 6 Million Crucifixions, How Christian Teachings About the Jews Paved the Road to the Holocaust. After the war ends and Poland and the other countries are liberated, there were pogroms taking place in Poland. What did the church do about those pogroms? That was after the Nazis lost the war.
Yes, yeah, there was a very, this was quite unfortunate. I mean, it was really not that surprising if you think about it this way. After the Second World War, the ancient hatred for Jews did not disappear. It would not just. I mean, if you hated Jews all your life, and during the war you killed Jews because you felt that they were hateful, and they had to be eliminated, you know, the fact that the war ended would not necessarily change this overnight. So yes, there were pogroms, and particularly in Poland, you know, Jews were of course decimated there. It was the greatest massacre of Jews occurred in Poland, and the remaining ones once the war ended were trying to come back home, and they somehow made it back to their villages and towns, only to find that their homes were taken over by their Christian neighbors, and that they couldn't go back to their houses because they didn't have any of those anymore. They didn't have any of their possessions. All this stuff had been taken away, and they were actually literally persecuted by the local population at that point. And the pogroms happened even after the war, and incidentally, they also happened. The other thing that happened, you were asking about the blood libel earlier,
right?
And there was one particular pogrom in 1946 in Poland, where they actually concocted this thing. They actually instructed, believe it or not, they instructed a child to complain that the Jews had kidnapped him and they wanted to kill him to extract his blood or kill him, And therefore, there was like a mock trial or something, and of course the child was forced to testify saying, yeah, the Jews did this, and therefore there was a pogrom. It was a massive revolt, and it was very violent. They destroyed a community center, and they killed a few Jews, some of which actually were not even there. They were just passing through this town, because, you know, remember, after the war, people were moving across Europe, you know, trying to find their way. So these were people who were completely innocent of anything because they were not in living there at the time. Yet they were attacked anyway just simply because they were Jews. And so this pogrom became very notorious, and because it not only was wrong, but also because, you know, Cardinal Hlong, who actually who was the primate of Poland at the time, he actually was asked, you know, how come you permit this? You know, what's going on? He said, well, you know, the Jews must have done it. That was basically his answer. You know, his response or his opinion was that, you know, there must be a reason for it. and this became particularly interesting many, many years later. This child, as a grown man, actually confessed that he had been made to lie and to say this about the Jews by his parents and uncle, I think it was, and some other family member. So this was a horrible thing, and it was horrible from every point of view, but it was interesting in the sense that, as opposed to the other blood libels of the Middle Ages and other times, this time the child, you know, became, you know, felt guilty about it and actually confessed later that it was all a lie. It was a concocted lie specifically designed to persecute Jews.
But the anti-Semites still wouldn't buy that. They would still argue that he was, and he's now under the influence of the Jew.
Yeah, the anti-Semites don't need to operate under the under reason. I mean, it doesn't have to be rational. They will do what they do, and it doesn't really matter what anybody says. You can actually, you know, prove the law of gravity in front of them, and they would argue that, no, it's not true, and the earth is flat. It doesn't really matter what you tell them.
Now, this post-World War II pogroms that were taking place in Poland, it wasn't just for a couple of people. I understand that maybe over 1,000 Jews were killed by the Poles when they went home.
Yeah, absolutely. This was happening all the time, and it was happening during the war, too. The Poles, actually, there was a militia. I can't remember the name. It was something with an S. It was some acronym for a Polish word. It just escapes my mind right now. But it was a militia of Poles, of Christian Poles, who persecuted Jews during the war as well. Like in Poland, of course, Jews were trying to hide wherever they could. They were being hounded by the Germans, but also by the Poles, which is the point here. They were trying to find shelter in forests, in farms. It didn't really matter. They would very gladly sleep under the hay, you know, with the cows or the pigs, and they would hide wherever they could. And then you would have these roving bands of armed Poles who were looking for them, and they were, like, you know, ferreting them out from their hiding places and either killing them themselves or handing them over to the Germans.
Okay. A further question. Was it John Paul II? He was the Polish Pope?
John Paul II was the Polish Pope, yes.
Okay. Now, what was his record during World War II in terms of the question of what was happening to the Jews? And what did he do in Poland when the pogroms took place after World War II? Did he address any of those questions?
I think he was a young man at the time. He was in the seminary, I believe, to study for the priesthood during that time or shortly after. Mm-hmm. He was against it. I think he was a good man who opposed this thing. He saw that this was an aberration and it was not the right Christian thing to do, so he felt bad about it even at that time. And I think he felt that he had to fight it in some way, but he also felt very strongly against communism, so he was trying to fight that as well, which he did all his life. And as a matter of fact, you know, John Paul II was, of course, very instrumental in the fight with communism during the Cold War, and was instrumental in the fall of communism in some ways.
How old was John Paul at 1945? How old was he at that time?
I don't know for sure, but he was a young man. He must have been in his teens, probably.
I think he must have been older. He must have been older. Okay? I would put him, How old would he be today if he still lived? I would take him to be in his 20s or 30s, so he must have been aware, hopefully, of the pogroms that were taking place. Incidentally, when I speak to some of my Christian friends on occasion, and I mention the Jews, you know, when they went back to Poland and were killed, the immediate response is, oh, by the Russians. I said, no, by the Poles. They can't process the information in their minds that evil is beyond communism.
Yeah. So he was born in 1920. So in 1945, he was 25 years old.
Right.
As I said, he was studying for the seminary at this time. He certainly knew of all the stuff that was going on against the Jews. He might have not known the particulars of some pogrom here or there, but he certainly knew of Polish persecution of Jews, and absolutely he knew German persecution of Jews.
Okay, now there's maybe a final question for this section. Is what's your comment for the expression that the church the Vatican saved more Nazis after the war than Jews during the war?
Well, it's hard to know the numbers of either of them for sure. If you count the number of Ustasha that were removed from Europe, the Galician division that was spirited out to the UK, it's possible that there were more fascists and Nazis than Jews. I don't know for sure. I don't think anybody knows for sure these numbers at this point. Maybe when the Vatican secret archives are open,
yeah,
and documentation comes to light as to acts of shelter and acts of saving Jews by the Vatican, we'll know. But for the time being, I don't think anybody knows for sure the exact numbers.
Okay. What do you think about the Pius XII's possibility of becoming a saint? Do you think that's on track?
Of being canonized?
Yeah.
I think it's a mistake to do it at this point. Obviously, it's the prerogative of the Church to canonize whoever they want. Mm-hmm. However, I think it would be premature to do it right now before the archives are open and independent scholars have a chance to evaluate what he did and what he didn't do during the war. So it is very possible that Pope Pius XII was a saintly man. However, before we know this for sure, and with all the controversy around him and with the speculation about what he did and he didn't do, it would be really premature to do it at this point.
Okay. I think in your book you have that quote by Pastor Niemöller. I think the quote was, when they came for the labor unions, I said nothing. When they came for the a communist, I didn't speak up. When they came for the Jews, I was silent. You're familiar with that.
Yeah. It was a poem that he composed.
Right.
He had that exactly.
Yeah. However, in the poem that I see written out, he also was mentioned, when they came for the Catholics, I didn't protest. That was never in the original poem.
I don't think he said that.
I have copies of the original poem from the German. He never said that. That was inserted probably by certain people who felt guilty that they weren't included in those who were persecuted by the Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
That was an add-on, which is an interest. Whenever I see it in public, I go over to whoever's responsible for it and say, where's that line coming from? That wasn't in the original quote. That was a...
You're right. I mean, I actually have the poem right in front of me,
right,
and in the original, and he doesn't say anything about the Catholics.
No, how did that come into existence? It had to come in, so people wouldn't get too upset about what took place.
Well, and it kind of makes you wonder, because they never came for the Catholics as Catholics. They may have come from Catholics who were...
Yeah, who would be left if they came after all of these people? What were left, the chickens? It's only us chickens that are murdering people?
I don't know, but, the reality is that, Niemöller actually was not a bad man per se, but he actually was, just like Pius XII, a fruit of his time, and he really absorbed the same teachings as everybody else in that period.
Okay, similarly with Bonhoeffer, he was a hero, but these guys are all anti-Semites, even though they're heroes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay, that's the world. You had the difference between the murderous anti-Semites and those that just hated them or spoke out against them. All right, I want to thank you for being interviewed, Gabriel, and your book is an important book. Okay, 6 million crucifixions, how Christian teaching. We have a little extra time. You mentioned if it wasn't for Christianity, there'd be no Holocaust.
I think it's very unlikely that would have been the case. No, the Holocaust, just like any other genocide, requires at least two things in order for them to happen. One of them is there has to be a pre-existing visceral hatred of one group by another. That's one of the two prerequisites. And the other one is there has to be some leadership, like political leaders who give the green light and provide the infrastructure or facilitate the genocide to happen. So without these two things, genocides just don't happen, period. And I'm talking about genocides in general, regardless of whether it's in Darfur, in Rwanda, or the Holocaust, or the Armenians, or whatever. If you look at the history of genocide, you will see these two things. Oh, in the case of the Holocaust, these two things were very, very visible. On the one hand, the pre-existing hatred of Jews was indisputable, and it had come from hundreds and hundreds of years of indoctrination of hatred toward Jews, which changed forms from an original theological to a later secular and racial form. However, it was a visceral hatred that already existed in most people in Europe. And then, of course, the other element was that the Nazis were in power, an all-powerful government who gave the green light to the population to go on a killing rampage. The Germans did not have to coax anyone to go and kill Jews. They just simply told them, go and kill them, and people went and killed them.
Mm-hmm. What about the idea that if no World War II, no Holocaust?
Absolutely not. No. The Holocaust happened under cover, if you will, of the Second World War. If the war had not erupted, I think it's very unlikely that the genocide would have happened in the way it did. The one thing that would have continued to happen was the elimination attempt of the Jews. Keep in mind that in 1930s Germany, the Germans made very strong efforts toward eliminating Jews from their midst. They passed the Nuremberg Laws in 1935, which were meant to exclude Jews from German life. They stripped their nationality. They prevented them from working in all sorts of professions, and they forced them to emigration. They forced them to leave the country. So, if the war had not erupted, we would have seen this this continued to the point of eliminating Jews from Germany entirely, but eliminating them by pushing them out of the way and not by killing them.
If they were to push them out of the way, which is an argument, where would they have gone? The Allies weren't letting them come into their countries.
Well, but, you know, if the war had not erupted, of course it's speculative. We'll never know what would have happened. But it's very possible, I don't know if very possible, it's certainly possible that they would have actually they would have gone somewhere. If the situation had gotten a lot worse in Germany, you know, the 1938 pogrom, the Kristallnacht pogrom, was a clear indication of how things were turning violent, and I think they could have continued that way. For sure it would have continued that way. Mm-hmm. I think it's very possible that American public opinion would have changed, you know, a few years after, and it's very possible that those anti-Semites in the State Department would have actually been forced to revert their policies and opened immigration to European Jews. I mean, of course, we'll never know, but I think it's very likely that this would have happened. It's also very possible that the same would have happened in the UK. I mean, Churchill was a friend of the Jews, and he would have seen that it was the situation in Germany was untenable for Jews. And Churchill was no dummy, just like Roosevelt was a very smart man, and he would have seen the benefit of importing, let's say, of accepting immigration by Jews, especially the German Jews, who were the most highly educated and talented Jews anywhere in Europe, probably. You know, these people were scientists and artists and engineers of the highest caliber. So they would have actually benefited from it. And I think they, you know, at the time of, in the 30s, they would not have accepted it. But I think that if things had continued to go really bad, it's possible that public opinion may have changed.
Okay, we have a little time, so perhaps we can I can continue raising some questions.
Sure.
What about Roosevelt and the charge that was made that why didn't he bomb the camps that the Jews were being exterminated in?
Well, it really wasn't up to Churchill. To Roosevelt to do this. This was really the War Department. They decided not to do this. The War Department, of course, is the predecessor of the. It was the ministry that was in charge of handling the war, and therefore they were the ones that had control over what the military did or didn't do, and what ostensibly was the reason at the time for not bombing the railroad tracks that went from Hungary to Auschwitz. Mm-hmm. Was because they were too far away and they couldn't divert military personnel or material into doing that sort of thing. They had to focus on winning the war. And as a matter of fact, Roosevelt often said this. We had to first focus on winning the war. Once if we beat the Nazis, then all this stuff is going to go away. So we need to beat the Nazis. That was the driving force behind everything they were doing. Mm-hmm. However, in reality, I think we now know that this was just lip service and it was not really true rationale for it, because the Allies were saying that they couldn't reach the railroad tracks, they were too far away. But we know now that this was not true, because once the American Allies and the British landed in Sicily and they were on the southern part of the Italian boot, they were already close enough to the Hungarian railroad tracks. So they could have actually reached them. When they continued to go up the boot, and especially after having gone over, liberated Rome and so on, they were already flying in that time frame. They were already flying into Poland. As a matter of fact, Auschwitz actually was three different camps: Auschwitz-Birkenau, and Auschwitz was the first, Birkenau was the second, and there was a third one called Monowitz. And Monowitz was an industrial camp. It was a slave labor camp where they had factories. IG Farben and others were there. And the Allies actually had bombed this camp. They actually had flown bombers, heavy bombers,
right,
and destroyed some of the facilities in this camp, in Auschwitz III. So the contention that they could not, go into Birkenau or Auschwitz in general and drop bombs there because it was too far away, or because they didn't have they didn't want to divert bombers from strategic bombing and, go there or whatever. All this stuff is just plain sad excuses, because the reality is they were bombing this camp that was in the neighborhood. It was just a few miles away. I think it was 3 miles away or five. So if you could drop bombs on a camp 5 miles away and you don't drop them on the concentration camp gas chambers, it's only because you didn't want to. Available to the Vatican through flyers thrown from the airplanes, in Vatican radio, BBC, or any other means of communication, talking from the pulpits, talking military chaplains talking to the troops in the front, any means of communication possible. If they had told the people killing the perpetrators, killing Jews, this is wrong, this is a crime, and this is a mortal sin, if they had excommunicated all these people,
right,
they had threatened with excommunication to these people and to the German hierarchy, I think this would have made a big difference. It may have actually triggered a moral revolt against genocide. I think it would have changed things. They did not do it.
If you were a Catholic that embraced communism, would he have excommunicated you?
He didn't do it during the war. He certainly did it after the war, when he had no qualms in excommunicating every single communist in the world at one stroke.
They didn't do it before the war? Wasn't there the threat of excommunication before World War II started? If you were a Catholic and you became a communist, you no longer were a Catholic. No?
He didn't excommunicate them during the war or before the war. He excommunicated them after the war.
Okay.
Also keep in mind that after the war, Pius XII was getting really nervous about communism. I mean, he had been really nervous since 1917, but after the war, when Stalin not only was standing, but was standing strong in Eastern Europe, he became really nervous. And also keep in mind that in post-war Italy, communism was taking hold. It was actually becoming really powerful.
I know.
And Pius XII was really, really afraid of a communist takeover of Italy, because he knew that would have been the end.
Right. But the fear among the West was that, and Stalin was part of that, was that when the elections come about after World War II in France and Italy, who's going to win the elections are the communists, because they were the only ones really fighting the Nazis.
Yeah.
This was the concern. That's why the United States was told, instructed the Italian-Americans, write your relatives in Italy, I think it was the election in 47, 48, tell them, don't vote communist. Don't vote, right, because Stalin was saying, okay, you guys, you like voting? Fine. I'll let them vote because I know who's going to win. But the United States helped stop that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not true that the communists were the only ones fighting the Nazis, obviously, but it was certainly true for a while, but not throughout the entire war.
Of all of them that were fighting the Nazis, it was the communists primarily. They didn't collaborate. They knew what that meant.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay? They were the ones, of all of them, they were the pure anti-Nazis in France and in Italy who were fighting against fascism. No way. Now, if the Pope had threatened excommunication to the German military, the troops, if they had killed Jews, would that have had an effect?
You know, I don't think it would have had much of an effect with some troops, especially the SS. I think the SS were probably beyond redemption. I mean, these people were so brainwashed and so fanatical that it probably would not have made much of a difference what the Pope said. However, you know, the SS was only a tiny fraction of the perpetrators. The SS were perhaps 100,000 people, and the perpetrators were millions. You know, the perpetrators were not just the people pulling the trigger. Perpetrators were the bystanders who were laughing at the Nazis taking a bearded Jew into the streets and cutting his beard, or you know, killing him in front of everyone, or making this guy brush the street with a toothbrush. The perpetrators were the train drivers, the train engineers who were taking the cattle car trains to the death camps. Mm-hmm. The perpetrators were the factory worker in Germany making Cyclone B, the poison gas that was used to kill Jews in gas chambers. So these were regular individuals. These were not fanatical SS henchmen. The perpetrators were also people who were not even German. The perpetrators were people in Lithuania or Ukraine who were very happy to comply with a request by the Germans to help them kill the Jews. They were the ones that were denouncing the Jews. Of course, these were the neighbors, so they were saying, you know, there's Moshe, the Jew. You know, they were like pointing at the neighbors because the Nazis couldn't tell sometimes who were the Jews. They didn't know where they were. So the neighbors, their Christian neighbors, were the ones denouncing them. Many times they were the ones helping the Germans round them up and take them to a forest. And often, and if not most of the times, especially at the beginning of the Holocaust, before the concentration camps began to be used as death camps, the murder was done by these roving killing squads, the Einsatzgruppen, and also the Order Police. And these people were going all along the Eastern Front, taking Jews from these little villages into ravines, into forests, and killing them at point-blank range sometimes, but oftentimes with machine guns at the edge of a mass grave. But the interesting thing about it is that the people manning the machine guns or the rifles or whatever other method of murder were not only uniformed SS. They were oftentimes Lithuanians and Latvians and Poles and Ukrainians and Romanians and other people as well. In France, for instance, France, of course, is a very Catholic country, and it's one of the church's favorite daughters. And in France, the deportation of the Jews into the Drancy camp before they were deported to the death camps was done entirely by gendarmes, the French police. These were not the Nazis. These were not German Gestapo or SS who rounded up the Jews. These were the French. They were regular French. They were the neighbors of the people. You know, these were regular folks who their children probably went to school with other Jewish children. These were the people who rounded up the Jews and handed them over to the Germans who later killed them. So, you know, these were regular individuals, and the important thing about it is that these individuals were not driven as the fanatical SS. They were not driven by a decade of racial propaganda, driven by the hundreds and hundreds of years of anti-Jewish contempt, anti-Jewish hatred instilled in them by the church.
Did the church make it easy for those to identify the Jews by on the baptismal papers that they supplied to the authorities?
They did, and this is was another unfortunate thing that happened. And but this was not the Catholic Church in general. This was particularly the German Catholic Church. But the German Protestant churches did as well. They, during the 1930s, the Germans were doing their typical census, and they didn't know who the Jews were. They couldn't tell, because in Germany the Jews were probably the most assimilated Jews of any other place, and so they couldn't tell. They didn't dress differently, they didn't speak differently, they didn't look differently at all. They were just like any regular German. So what the German authorities did is they went to the churches and they asked them for baptismal records, which the church very happily complied with, and they gave them the baptismal records. They gave them this, which was instrumental in allowing the German authorities to know who was a Christian, and by opposition, who was a Jew. That's how they identified who was a Christian, because they were baptized. And they knew who the Jews were, and then they knew where they lived and everything. And they actually tabulated this with machines provided by IBM Germany, and they actually kept very meticulous records, as is typical of the Germans. And they knew exactly who they were, what kind of income they had, where they lived, you know, all the stuff they knew. And when the genocide, I mean the persecution was gradual, right? You started by stripping the Jews of nationality and preventing them from holding office and preventing them from being professors in universities and schools and so on. But by the time it became genocidal, you know, toward the Second World War time frame, in 1939 and onwards, they actually went straight to the Jews, because they know who they were and they knew where they lived, thanks to the church in great part.
Okay. Again, my guest, Gabriel Walensky, his book, important read, 6 Million Crucifixions, How Christian Teachings About the Jews Paved the Road to the Holocaust. After the war ends and Poland and the other countries are liberated, there were pogroms taking place in Poland. What did the church do about those pogroms? That was after the Nazis lost the war.
Yes. Yeah, there was a very... This was quite unfortunate. I mean, it was really not that surprising if you think about it this way. After the Second World War, the ancient hatred for Jews did not disappear. If you hated Jews all your life and during the war you killed Jews because you felt that they were hateful, and they had to be eliminated, you know, the fact that the war ended would not necessarily change this overnight. So yes, there were pogroms, and particularly in Poland, you know, Jews were of course decimated there. It was the greatest massacre of Jews occurred in Poland, and the remaining ones, once the war ended, were trying to come back home, and they somehow made it back to their villages and towns, only to find that their homes were taken over by their Christian neighbors. And that they couldn't go back to their houses because they didn't have any of those anymore. They didn't have any of their possessions. All this stuff had been taken away. And they were actually literally persecuted by the local population at that point. And the pogroms happened even after the war. And incidentally, they also happened. The other thing that happened, you were asking about the blood libel earlier.
Right.
And there was one particular pogrom in 1946 in Poland where they actually concocted this thing. They actually instructed, believe it or not, they instructed a child to complain that the Jews had kidnapped him and they wanted to kill him to extract his blood or kill him.
Oh.
And therefore, there was like a mock trial or something, and of course the child was forced to testify saying, yeah, the Jews did this, and therefore there was a pogrom. It was a massive revolt, and it was very violent. They destroyed a community center, and they killed a few Jews, some of which actually were not even there. They were just passing through this town, because, you know, remember, after the war, people were moving across Europe, you know, trying to find their way. So these were people who were completely innocent of anything because they were not in living there at the time. Yet they were attacked anyway just simply because they were Jews. And so this pogrom became very notorious, and because it not only was wrong, but also because, you know, Cardinal Hlong, who actually who was the primate of Poland at the time, he actually was asked, you know, how come you permit this? You know, what's going on? He said, well, you know, the Jews must have done it. That was basically his answer. You know, his response or his opinion was that, you know, there must be a reason for it. And this became particularly interesting many, many years later. This child, as a grown man, actually confessed that he had been made to lie and to say this about the Jews by his parents and uncle, I think it was, and some other family member. So this was a horrible thing, and it was horrible from every point of view, but it was interesting in the sense that, as opposed to the other blood libels of the Middle Ages and other times, this time the child, you know, became, you know, felt guilty about it and actually confessed later that it was all a lie. It was a concocted lie specifically designed to persecute Jews.
But the anti-Semites still wouldn't buy that. They would still argue that he was, and he's now under the influence of the Jew.
Yeah, the anti-Semites don't need to operate under the under reason. I mean, it doesn't have to be rational. They will do what they do, and it doesn't really matter what anybody says. You can actually, you know, prove the law of gravity in front of them, and they would argue that, no, it's not true, and the earth is flat. It doesn't really matter what you tell them.
Now, this post-World War II pogroms that were taking place in Poland, it wasn't just for a couple of people. I understand that maybe over 1,000 Jews were killed by the Poles when they went home.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. This was happening all the time, and it was happening during the war, too. The Poles, actually, there was a militia. I can't remember the name. It was something with an S. It was some acronym for a Polish word that just escapes my mind right now. But it was a militia of Poles, of Christian Poles, who persecuted Jews during the war as well. Like in Poland, of course, Jews were trying to hide wherever they could. They were being hounded by the Germans, but also by the Poles, which is the point here. They were trying to find shelter in forests, in farms. It didn't really matter. They would very gladly sleep under the hay, you know, with the cows or the pigs, and they would hide wherever they could. And then you would have these roving bands of armed Poles who were looking for them, and they were, like, you know, ferreting them out from their hiding places and either killing them themselves or handing them over to the Germans.
Okay, I'm speaking with Gabriel Wilinski. We're talking about his book titled 6 Million Crucifixions. There's a lot more to the book than what we can get to today. Hey, I want to thank you very much for the book and for the conversation. It's an important book, and hopefully people will, you know, settle in center and get an idea of what it is, not only to be a Jew, but what it was to be an anti-Semite. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm looking forward to speaking with you again. And for those listeners that want to get some more information in the meantime, you can go to 6millioncrucifixions.com, the website for the book, and I have plenty of information there.
Thank you very, very much, Gabriel.
Thank you. We'll talk to you soon.
See you. Bye-bye.